In February of 1992, the U.S. House of Representatives held a subcommittee hearing on the new Occupational Safety and Health Administration standard on bloodborne pathogens, 1 month before the standard went into effect. The chair, Congressman Ron Wyden of Oregon, criticized OSHA for failing to address the problem of needle stick injuries and the risk of HIV infection to nurses and other healthcare workers. He observed that the standard did not, quote, go beyond the use of high-strength gloves and masks in surgery, unquote, and failed to demand the use of safer needles, connective devices, and IV lines, the source of real disease risk to workers. At the time, there were an estimated 1 million accidental needle sticks per year in the United States, resulting in some 300 deaths annually from hepatitis B among healthcare workers and an unknown but increasing number of occupational HIV infections. The scale of the problem was likely underreported. Peggy Farrow, testifying under the name Jean Roe, was the first witness before the subcommittee. A certified nursing assistant since 1969, Farrow worked at a major private hospital in San Francisco, as she called it, but offered testimony only under the strictest confidentiality. Her testimony was direct. "I am a healthcare worker who is now HIV infected from a needle stick injury," she said. "This is a documented occupational transmission. Casting doubt on existing statistics about occupational HIV/AIDS exposure, the witness pointed out that because her HIV disease had not progressed into full-blown AIDS, she was not yet classified under the Centers for Disease Control HIV/AIDS surveillance report. She explained how she acquired HIV on the job in 1990. She had been cleaning a patient's bedside table. The patient was newly admitted to my unit and was medically unstable," she recounted. "My first priority was my patient's medical status, stabilizing his condition and keeping him alive. That night, I was also responsible for two other patients, one of whom was also medically unstable. I was trying to cope with the very heavy patient caseload." Concerned for her patient, Farrow was exposed to an unprotected needle with enough HIV-contaminated blood to infect me and change my life forever, she said. Farrow's testimony points to three issues we will explore in this essay. The first is the literally precarious nature of women's work in the healthcare industry, not just in terms of flexible employment, but in terms of physical risk. Occupational health hazards facing nurses and other predominantly female care workers are a crucial but still greatly underexplored facet of workplace studies and the history of women workers in the late 20th century. Further, Farrow testified that she contracted HIV not only because her employer failed to purchase safer needles, but due to increasing care loads for healthcare workers. The intensification of women's care labor must be placed in the context of the rise of managed care, the restructuring of care work, and occupational health policy in the 1980s. Second, Farrow drew attention to the failure of both OSHA and the CDC to adequately address the health risks facing women workers in particular. Occupational health research has long privileged catastrophic injury over chronic disease, and workers' compensation boards routinely grant substantially more and greater compensation awards to workers with occupational injuries than to those who contracted diseases in the workplace. OSHA's original mandate focused on the construction trades and manufacturing work, and physical hazards and toxic substances were its chief concerns. Moreover, OSHA was chronically underfunded and under heavy scrutiny from its origins. Thus, the daily exposure of healthcare workers and others to biological hazards was outside of the central concerns and the resources of OSHA and the CDC, both of which faced budgetary and political challenges. Occupational exposure to HIV/AIDS provides a particularly vivid example of this larger problem. In the 1980s, the disease was the subject of a wide-ranging and sometimes panicked debate in healthcare and policy circles. Beyond the etiology and course of the disease, healthcare workers, medical researchers, and hospital administrators argued about the forms of HIV transmission, the treatment of the disease, and the appropriate medical and social response to the growing HIV/AIDS epidemic. The first widely discussed case of occupational transmission stirred controversies about how to control the risks healthcare workers faced, even as doctors and administrators faced mandatory testing of surgical patients and healthcare workers and advocated the use of hazard suits in emergency rooms. Although the number of healthcare workers who contracted HIV on the job remained small, almost all of them through accidental needle stick injuries, the importance of the occupational cases was magnified by the vexed intersection of fear, gender, and health policy. In many ways, nurses' contraction of HIV from needle stick injuries exposed the contradictions in occupational healthcare policy as well as in the political response to AIDS. Women healthcare workers and their unions struggled to respond to the threat of occupational exposure in the context of the Reagan administration's hostility to OSHA and also their resistance to federal funding of HIV/AIDS research. More importantly, economic restructuring in the healthcare industry and the rise of managed care led to higher workloads, increased stress, and employer resistance to the adoption of new, costlier medical equipment, no matter how safe. This leads to the final theme of Farrow's testimony, how women workers and their unions challenged employers, OSHA, and elected officials in Washington, D.C. to address workplace health hazards through unions like SEIU and through women's gay rights and public health organizations. We focus first on the SEIU campaign against occupational HIV transmission, from the union's first AIDS Education Committee in 1983 to its lobbying efforts to secure an OSHA standard on bloodborne pathogens from 1987 to 1991. Second, we trace the SEIU needle stick campaign through 2000, culminating in the passage of the Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act. The SEIU campaign took place in the context of massive economic restructuring in the healthcare industry and the ongoing opposition of conservative politicians and business lobbying groups to strong OSHA enforcement. The passage of the Needle Stick Safety Act, which went much farther in protecting healthcare workers than the 1991 OSHA standard, was a major achievement against such odds. Finally, we ask how examining occupational health and safety in the increasingly precarious work of healthcare contributes to our understandings of workplace conditions and policies. As long as bloodborne pathogens remain the single major occupational hazard in the healthcare industry, its workers remain on the front line of occupational health and safety battles today. Hard hats, dust masks, and welding goggles, not latex gloves and self-blending syringes, dominate the iconography of occupational health and safety in America. For most people, the phrase occupational hazard brings to mind blue-collar men, not women, heavy industry, not service work. These associations obscure the work experience of contemporary workers, especially women and minorities, in ever more dangerous and toxic workplaces. In the decades since the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, was passed in 1970, unions like the Service Employees International Union and the American Federation of Municipal Employees have aggressively and effectively lobbied for new OSHA standards to protect their disproportionately female members, many of whom work in the low-wage service sector. At a time when most industrial unions in the United States were losing membership due to union busting, downsizing, and plant closures, the SEIU is expanding. Its success was due less to organizing new members than to President George Hardy's reach-out strategy of affiliating with and incorporating smaller independent unions. Such mergers added 230,000 members to SEIU between 1971 and 1985, bringing the total membership to roughly 635,000. Between 1980 and 1984, under President John Sweeney, the SEIU gained another 160,000 members through four mergers. In the process, SEIU absorbed hundreds of thousands of members in the healthcare industry, including nurses, health and human services workers, and hospital staff. As a result, the union became one of the leading advocates of new occupational safety measures and the central force in the fight for an OSHA standard on bloodborne pathogens. One of the larger locals within SEIU is Local 250, representing some 30,000 workers in the Bay Area, including San Francisco General Hospital in the Mission District. Between 1986 and 1991, Local 250 members played a key role in lobbying for the passage of OSHA's bloodborne pathogen standard. First, San Francisco General led the nation in the diagnosis and treatment of HIV/AIDS. Local 250's location at the epicenter of the HIV/AIDS epidemic presented the union with opportunities to lead on the issue. While hepatitis B was a much greater threat to healthcare workers than HIV, the national AIDS crisis heightened public sensitivity to the dangers of bloodborne pathogens and provided unions, chiefly SEIU and AFSCME, with political leverage at a time of retrenchment for organized labor and social regulations. In the early 1980s, the prospects for lobbying OSHA to better protect the nation's healthcare workers were not bright. From its origins, OSHA was an embattled, underfunded agency. During the Nixon and Ford administrations, OSHA pursued a cautious policy of targeting small businesses rather than large corporations. It developed only three standards for asbestos, vinyl chloride, and a package standard for 14 carcinogens in its first 3 years. While OSHA slowly established standards for major industrial hazards such as cotton dust, pesticides, heat stress, and coke oven emissions, inspectors focused on small trucking, construction, and heavy industrial firms. OSHA all but ignored sectors of the economy with predominantly female workforces. Above all, it neglected the healthcare industry. In 1977, under the leadership of Carter appointee Dr. Eula Bingham, OSHA began to ramp up inspections, enforcement, new workplace standards, and worker education. Still, the economic crisis of the 1970s and aggressive counterattacks from industry pressured the Carter administration to make concessions to deregulation. It adopted cost-benefit criteria for OSHA standards, which had been inaugurated by Carter's Regulatory Analysis and Review Group in 1978. In 1981, the Reagan administration replaced the heads of OSHA and the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, cut the funding and staff at both agencies, and folded the latter into the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta. Under its new leadership, OSHA emphasized consultation with employers rather than labor unions, and voluntary guidelines rather than mandatory workplace inspections and penalties. The American healthcare system at that time was undergoing what historical sociologist Paul Starr labeled a dramatic corporate expansion. As national health insurance receded from the policymaking horizon in the 1970s, regional healthcare conglomerates organized under the aegis of managed care captured an ever greater share of the hospital services market. Managed care typically entailed cost-cutting measures that increased workloads for hospital staff and proved resistant to new technologies. Rising patient-to-nurse ratios, moreover, placed greater strains on nurses and ancillary healthcare workers. Between 1981 and 1993, the number of bedside nursing caregivers in hospitals in the United States declined by 7.3%, while managed care providers increased the patient-to-nurse ratio. In 1983, the federal Medicare program began paying hospitals a flat rate for treating patients based on diagnosis rather than patient services. A study of hospitals in the San Francisco Bay Area found that the 1983 change in Medicare policy inaugurated, quote, a new era of managerial control and market mechanisms, unquote, that encouraged caseloads. AIDS thus arrived on the American epidemiological scene at a time when healthcare workers were under increasing job stress, and the federal government was retreating from OSHA's original mandate to protect all workers from occupational health and safety hazards. Members of SEIU Local 250, especially those who worked at San Francisco General Hospital, were well placed to appreciate how these forces made them more vulnerable to occupational risks. San Francisco General Hospital became the nation's first hospital with a specialized HIV/AIDS clinic located in wards 86 and 5B. Doctors at SFGH established the clinic to treat patients with a new mysterious immunological disorder that appeared in gay male patients in cities from Miami to Los Angeles. Initially called Kaposi's sarcoma, opportunistic infections syndrome, it began. It began being called gay-related immune deficiency in 1982 after the Centers for Disease Control coined the term. San Francisco General's clinic also became the leader in addressing the risks of occupational transmission of the disease. Unions like SEIU and AskMe, representing hundreds of thousands of healthcare workers, already were acutely aware of increasing occupational exposure to bloodborne pathogens, especially the hepatitis B virus. The most common form of occupational transmission for HBV was accidental needle stick injuries, a daily occurrence in the nation's hospitals. A study of the University of Wisconsin's hospital from 1975 to 1979, for example, found that the average annual rate of accidental needle sticks was 92.6 per thousand among nurses and 127 per thousand among housekeeping and service maintenance staff. Although a hepatitis B vaccine came on the market in 1981, most healthcare employers were not willing to pay $100 or more per worker for a series of vaccination shots. Many healthcare workers were unaware of the vaccine, and even those who were aware often could not afford it. The result was that vaccination rates lingered below 5% through the 1980s. In 1983 alone, an estimated 17,000 healthcare workers contracted hepatitis B from occupational exposure, and an average of 300 died from such exposures annually in the United States. In 1983, OSHA distributed a set of guidelines to healthcare industry employers designed to reduce the risk of occupational exposure to hepatitis B virus. The guidelines included a description of the disease and recommendations for use of the new HBV vaccine. In keeping with Reagan-era policy, the guidelines emphasized voluntary compliance rather than mandatory standards. In practice, voluntary meant that healthcare employers continued to deny HPV vaccination to their employees. Many healthcare workers and union activists recognized that OSHA's measures were radically insufficient, both for the purposes of education and in regulating labor practices. In effect, it meant that hepatitis B remained a major occupational risk. In 1983, as the HIV/AIDS epidemic became more visible, several members of SEIU Local 250 formed an AIDS education committee called AEC. AEC produced a brochure entitled AIDS and the Healthcare Worker to educate workers about the risks of occupational exposure and AIDS discrimination issues. AEC also conducted educational workshops for union stewards and hospital staff. By 1990, AIDS and the Healthcare Worker had gone through 5 editions, and SEIU had distributed hundreds of thousands of copies in the United States and around the world. Early on, SEIU members realized that union educational efforts were not enough to protect healthcare workers from AIDS, however. The union's long-standing concerns about hepatitis B transmission shaped their response to the new biological threat. This is not surprising. AIDS was not yet a documented occupational disease, while HPV continued to claim the lives of hundreds of healthcare workers annually. Only the federal government, by issuing an OSHA standard for bloodborne pathogens, had the power to compel the nation's healthcare employers to adopt stronger infection control measures. In 1983, SEIU President John Sweeney wrote a letter to the American Public Health Association announcing SEIU's campaign for a new standard. Alluding to the limitations of voluntary guidelines, Sweeney wrote that we will petition OSHA to reinforce its correct advice with a clear directive that employers must pay for an HPV vaccine. HIV/AIDS and hepatitis B would become linked causes in the struggle for a safer healthcare workplace. SEIU understood the power of that linkage. SEIU Health and Safety Director Bill Borwegan believed that public fear of AIDS could provide the support needed for bloodborne pathogen standard. His logic was pragmatic, not cynical. Reagan administration officials were hostile to both unions and health and safety regulation, but they would be hard-pressed to reject safeguards against a terrifying, mysterious national epidemic. Moreover, the AIDS crisis had the potential to forge new and more powerful activist coalitions. In September 1986, SEIU and AskMe sent petitions to OSHA demanding the replacement of voluntary guidelines for bloodborne pathogens with mandatory standards. Union leaders soon discovered, however, that OSHA officials were not sympathetic. Reagan's Assistant Secretary of Labor for OSHA, John Prendergast, was reluctant to classify infectious diseases as occupational hazards. Union leaders had to take their petitions to Congress, which resulted in hearings investigated by congressional Democrats, including Tom Lantos of California and Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts. Well, the first hearing, Need for Immediate OSHA Regulations to Protect Healthcare Workers for AIDS, as it was called, reflected the immediacy of the AIDS crisis, SEIU leaders continued to see HPV as the paramount occupational health hazard facing healthcare workers. Several high-profile cases of occupational HIV transmission that year, however, reinforced the seriousness of the AIDS threat. During the hearings, OSHA and the CDC came under fire from congressional Democrats, union activists, and physicians for what Congressman Lantos called the glacial pace of standard setting. OSHA staffer Susan Harwood risked her career by speaking out against Prendergast and other Reagan appointees, whom she charged with deliberately stalling as long as possible. By continuing to allow healthcare providers to deny their employees HPV vaccinations, OSHA was at least partially responsible for what were, by its own calculations, between 167 and 202 annual healthcare worker deaths from occupational HPV exposure. These deaths, along with the new threat of occupational transmission of HIV/AIDS, were considered to be a powerful motivation for OSHA to act. OSHA did not publish its notice of proposed rulemaking until 1989, several months after the hearings ended. The standard for bloodborne pathogens was officially used only in 1991. As William Maraskin has argued, the 1991 standard was a very far-reaching one, and encompassed most, though not all, of what the union sought. One of its key omissions, however, was an explicit statement requested by SEIU and AskMe, but dropped by OSHA staffers, mandating engineering controls for safe needles. As several high-profile needle stick infections during the hearing process illustrated, the omission was a glaring one. OSHA's failure to mandate engineering controls, especially safer needles, left workers like Peggy Farrow at risk for HIV and other bloodborne pathogens. Whatever immediate clarity the standard brought, the continued exposure of healthcare workers to Sharps injuries necessitated another decade of union activism, culminating in the Needlestick Safety and Prevention Act of 2000. In July 1987, a 25-year-old nurse at San Francisco General Hospital named Mary McGee was changing a patient's needle in the HIV/AIDS ward. The needle, unsheathed and filled with blood, was used to connect the patient's IV tubing to Heplock tubing. As she later recalled, the ward was crowded. The nearest Sharps disposal container was located on the other side. Before she could safely dispose of the needle, she accidentally stuck herself with it. She was tested several days later as HIV negative. A follow-up test in September, however, showed that she was HIV positive. McGee found herself with a dilemma. She did not want to lose her job or to sacrifice her career. If she went on workers' compensation, she would reveal her disease status to her coworkers and to the larger medical community. Fearing discrimination in employment, insurance, and in treatment, McGee engaged in a 2-year struggle with the California Workers' Compensation Board to grant her workers' compensation while keeping her name and condition private. She only revealed her name publicly more than 20 years later. Like other workers who contracted AIDS, McGee was faced with escalating medical costs, including antiviral medications that protected her life and extended her health, amounting to thousands of dollars per year. To the costs of treatment were added lost work days and pay as McGee, like other workers, took sick days to recover from the flu-like symptoms of seroconversion. Despite the difficulty in receiving an award, workers' compensation still only partially paid for the costs of contracting HIV on the job. Meanwhile, McGee participated in SEIU AIDS education workshops under the name Jane Doe. She and other nurses and healthcare workers organized and lobbied for improved medical equipment, confidentiality as a guard against discrimination, and for new safety standards that might reduce the risks of contracting HIV on the job. She later testified before Congress about the conditions of her injury and what might have prevented it. Other union members testifying in state and congressional hearings used the story of Jane Doe to illustrate the dangers of standard needles. McGee was not the first healthcare worker to become occupationally infected by HIV. The Center for Disease Control's May 22, 1987 Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report provided several case reports of healthcare workers who became HIV positive after exposure to infected blood. One of them, a female phlebotomist, was infected when the top of a 10 millimeter vacuum blood collection tube blew off and blood splattered around the room on her face and in her mouth. Another, a female medical technologist, was infected by blood spilled on her arms and gloveless hands, although she had no visible open wounds. By 1989, the CDC estimated that 22 healthcare workers with no other risk factors had become HIV positive from occupational exposure. Some medical professionals, however, called the figure overly conservative, so it might have been well over 22. McGee's case played an important role in the SEIU campaign. As Lorraine Day, the chief orthopedic surgeon at San Francisco General Hospital, testified at a congressional oversight hearing on OSHA, "The Centers for Disease Control have told us over and over again that the risk of a healthcare worker contracting AIDS from occupational exposure is low. I believed that until October 2, 1987, when a woman nurse at our hospital turned HIV positive from one needle stick on the job." By 1989, McGee was only one of numerous healthcare workers who suffered from occupational HIV transmission from accidental needle stick injuries. Over the next 3 years, OSHA scheduled hearings in Washington, D.C., New York, San Francisco, and Miami. As OSHA officials drafted the final standard with what seemed an agonizing slowness to many observers, needlestick HIV transmissions continued to accumulate. Two cases played a particularly important role in the SEIU campaign. The first concerned Peggy Farrow, the certified nursing assistant whose case became a major focal point of the hearings. Speaking as Jean Rowe, she presented her testimony to Campaign for Engineering Controls, more specifically safety syringes and other blood collection devices, in the healthcare workplace. "Being told by management to be more careful," she testified, "is meaningless when you are working 12 to 16 hour shifts. Being called in early, carrying double patient loads, and facing a shortage of trained staff." Farrow forcefully argued The technology was available in 1990 to prevent my needle stick injury. At that time, my hospital did not use safer needle-bearing devices. I am now infected. Unsafe medical devices must be taken off the market and medical facilities instructed to choose the best available technology on the market. Farrow gave her testimony after OSHA's bloodborne pathogen standard had been drafted. The standard lacked both employer incentives and sufficient penalties. The standard, as it was passed, offered little consolation to workers like her. In effect, Farrow explained why the campaign to meaningfully implement the standard, then led by SEIU and its community allies, would continue until engineering controls were put in place. The second case involved Janet Christensen, a registered nurse at San Francisco General Hospital, who testified after Farrow. Farrow was not anonymous because she had not been infected, or rather, Christensen was not anonymous because she had not been infected with HIV. Instead, she had accidentally infected a medical student with HIV while he was standing at her patient's bedside in 1991. Christensen explained that as she was withdrawing an HIV-infected needle from a patient's vein, the medical student's free hand swung back and hit the contaminated stylet on the fleshy palm side of his hand. The incident would not have occurred, she believed, if the AIDS clinic had been equipped with another product, the self-covering Criticon AngioCath, which was standard issue in the San Francisco General Hospital emergency room at the time. More than 10 years after the AIDS epidemic broke in 1981, and 5 years after the SEIU and Ask Me campaigns began, OSHA issued its first bloodborne pathogen standard. The standard mandated HPV vaccinations, an important step in the nationwide battle against hepatitis B. The standard was useless, however, in preventing the over 1 million accidental needle sticks in the nation's hospitals that occurred every year. Moreover, 6 years after the passage of the standard, OSHA inspectors had carried out only 200 inspections of healthcare facilities to enforce it. Given widespread underreporting of needle sticks and the lack of mandatory engineering controls, healthcare employers had no incentive to purchase more expensive safety syringes. Manufacturers had every incentive to continue selling lower-cost needles. It would take another decade of activism led by SEIU members like McGee, Farrow, and Christensen to win more effective legislation. Establishing a bloodborne pathogen standard answered the need to deal with hepatitis B infections, but it did little to change conditions that created more than 800,000 reported needle stick injuries a year, or the specific risk of contracting HIV after an accidental needle stick. Changes in work practices, safer needles, or needle-free blood collection devices would be the main paths by which nurses and other healthcare workers could reduce the epidemic of injury in the healthcare workplace. OSHA's failure to adequately regulate or inspect healthcare facilities, the failure of regulation to require engineering controls, lack of adequate training, new chemical agents and technologies, the weakness or absence of collective bargaining agreements to ensure improved working conditions, and the continued and intensifying pace of work in hospitals and other care units further undermined the safety of healthcare workers. By 1999, as SEIU and other organizations kept lobbying for needle stick safety legislation, OSHA at last joined the effort. 20 states already had pending needle safety laws to reduce the risk of contracting HIV and hepatitis B through sharps injuries. California, the state where the state level OSHA had prepared the way to mandate new needle technologies, passed a law that went into effect in July 1999. Now was the time for a federal standard, the best means for reducing life-threatening injuries. Peter Stark of California, or a Democratic congressman from California, and Marge Rukama, a Republican congresswoman from New Jersey, co-sponsored the Health Care Worker Prevention Act of 1999 for that reason. As Stark argued, healthcare workers should not have to risk their lives while saving the lives of their patients. Safe needle devices are used in some facilities across the country, but our bill would make use of safe technology the norm rather than the exception. Hospitals, healthcare providers, and medical equipment manufacturers, among others, resisted the pressure to implement these changes. Their argument rested on cost-benefit analysis. HIV transmission and seroconversion were relatively rare, constituting only a small percentage, 1 to 2% of all needle stick injuries. Safer equipment, they pointed out, was much more expensive. Phlebotomy needles cost only 10 cents for a conventional device and 33 cents for a safer version. Implementing that one change would cost a 250 to 300-bed hospital $15,000 a year. Shifting to safer devices for the butterfly needle would cost an additional 25 cents per needle or $4,000 a year for an average hospital. For an IV, the improved catheter would cost $1 more per unit, or $33,500. For a hypodermic syringe, 20 cents, or $67,000 per year for the same hospital. Hospitals argued that there was both increased cost and staff resistance to implementation, that there were both problems with compatibility and with prior medical equipment contracts. As late as 2000, union representatives continued to complain about OSHA's failure to address the rising tide of needle stick injuries. Bill Borwegan, SEIU Health and Safety Director, declared it a no-brainer to require safer needles for use in healthcare. State legislatures, Borwegan said, were left with the impression that OSHA is out of touch and incapable of tackling one of the more glaring, clear-cut, and readily addressed occupational health and safety hazards confronting workers in one of the fastest growing sectors of the economy. Now, this is a preliminary version of the paper, so the final version will be somewhat expanded, but I'll just move on to the conclusion. The OSHA Standard and Needle Stick Safety Act did make a difference, but risks remain. Women are at particular risk, as women constitute nearly 80% of workers in the healthcare field, and nursing has become, as the SEIU has argued, a dangerous profession. In fact, nurses are only third ranked of those groups in risk, as housekeeping and food service workers have much higher injury rates. The intensification of labor in a world of corporate managed healthcare continues to make work in the healthcare industry more dangerous than it need be. Needle stick injuries remain a hazard to workers across a range of healthcare occupations. In this time of budgetary restraint, deregulation of industry, and underfunding of workplace oversight, voluntary associations like unions and community organizations are the only forces pushing for continued reform and new standards of workplace safety. Thank you.
Well, I will say that one of the questions that actually started us down this path, we were just going to explore occupational health and safety for women. And the question that came immediately to mind when I think about the past 30 years was, what difference had AIDS made in the workplace? And I recall all of the panic stuff that went on, precisely that. The patients were victimized by dentists or doctors or nurses who were giving them AIDS. And then there's this whole backstory that we didn't hear about, which is, and I think some of the most interesting stuff that was going on in California in terms of the media actually covered the workers' story better than the national story did, which is, you know, the national media was focused on these sensational cases. There are also sensational cases among the workers, but it was primarily the California media that was doing it. And there's actually a really interesting set of interviews of the AIDS crisis in I think it's mostly in California, where they do these interviews, and you read precisely this: the surprise, the alarm. Lorraine Day, who I think is the mm-hmm. is the surgeon, was both the leader in some ways in demanding safety equipment, but also the one who ran around wanting to test everybody, who became the authoritarian, who wanted, you know, to wear a spacesuit into the OR, and who wanted mandatory patient testing, which at the time were just this extraordinary measure to deal with a disease that no one understood. And that was really the stories that sort of sucked us in. I think the surprising things, and it's, again, we're still sort of trying to hone the focus as well as we really need to sort of finish the last part of the article. And that's my job, by the way. Joe did his job very well. I think the surprising story is that the primary people who get infected with HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis B in the hospital workplace are the maintenance workers, they're the food service workers, they're the healthcare workers who are not the professionals. And while nurses certainly were front line in trying to deal with this, it's sort of the amazing thing that there was no discussion of it at all. And it's in part because of having a family member who was a clinic cleaner for a while, you know, as a contract worker trying to subsidize their kids' college education. My sister and her husband were cleaning clinics. And he gets stuck with a needle one night, and yeah. extraordinary measures that were done, giving him antivirals, and I mean, you know, it's a happy ending to the story. But until that was aware, I mean, who would have thought about these relatively innocent things? But it really is sort of the corporatization of American medicine, this push to continually reduce costs by speeding up the work and then refusing to implement these engineering controls, which, I mean, the real key is that they didn't want to buy more expensive needles. Needles that would have saved thousands of lives and billions of dollars. And there is a kind of a cold-hearted calculus when you actually read about some of the documents about this, where they literally say, well, the cost of a single healthcare worker getting AIDS is maybe $250,000, whereas if we implement safer needles for everybody, it'll cost us so much more. So we'd rather pay the $250,000 than deal with these costs across the board. So, you know, and these things are sort of tearing at the middle of this story.
Great. Sure. I had two questions. What happened to nursing aide Peggy Farrell?
She died in 1998. Mary McGee is still alive and recently outed herself, took away her anonymity. But Peggy Farrell died of AIDS in 98. It's in the footnotes, but it probably should be in the main narrative more.
I have a second question, if that's all right. Is it not true that if it's considered a women's profession, it gets less attention among government regulation and legislation than it would if it were common among men?
Well, that's what we call a tag question. I think obviously this has been true. I mean, we know from all kinds of aspects of policy and medicine that we use a male standard and we don't often look to what women are doing. I think that the heart of the OSHA issue literally is that they are oriented, as much of occupational medicine was oriented, toward the big injuries, the things that are bloody and awful and you see them immediately, the burns, the splinters, and then later cancer. And it just, the stuff that didn't fit within their purview was the diseases. They're actually fairly, I have another student who finished a few years ago who was working on black lung, and both the miners organizing against it and the phenomena itself and the struggle for compensation. Black lung is also an occupational disease that takes, but actually takes a long time to go into place, and there's enormous resistance toward compensating minors. So then you throw in all of the other aspects of hepatitis B and hepatitis C, and then HIV/AIDS, which are, I think, in a kind of bureaucratic mind, these are also, especially HIV/AIDS, is about it's a lifestyle disease to some people. I mean, that is the perception of certain bureaucrats. Even when it was proven that HIV/AIDS had nothing, you know, it's certainly not the kind of implication that they wanted to put on it. If you sort of double down on that and think about the fact that while HIV/AIDS can be at very rapid onset, you can get false negatives for a while. It may not necessarily present itself. It feels like the flu when you seroconvert. And there was so much panic about it that even the people who contracted it were eager to hide it, knew that it had costs for them professionally, personally. So I think gender is a huge part of it, and certainly the association of HIV/AIDS with sexual transmission. I mean, some of these congressmen and policymakers are literally talking about, you know, I don't remember if it's Peggy Farrell or Mary McGee, where they talk about the fact that the people who originally find out it's an occupational transmission, doubt it, and they want to know her sexual history. They want to know if she's a drug user, because they simply do not want to accept occupational transmission. So it's the combination of gender and sexuality issues around it, combined with the sort of, I suppose, the resistance of employers and the state to take responsibility for something that's not catastrophic. Yes?
I always like to add a bit of a perspective on that. And I spent my first 20 years in healthcare, and then my second 20 years of a career in Michigan OSHA. And my background was microbiology. And I worked in a lab where I opened up 200 years. Now, in terms of, was anybody interested in the injuries and the illnesses of healthcare workers being 80% women? No. I used to smoke cigarettes sitting on top of 5-gallon flammable liquids, and I have a good background in chemistry at Eno Medical Center here in town. All right. There was very little attention, even with the college degree individual. So, plus, we already know that for year after year after year after year, 200 to 300 healthcare workers died of hepatitis B, and we didn't do crap about it. We didn't talk about it. We didn't add it up. It wasn't until HIV that got it. And the percentage of how many HIV then and now compared to hepatitis B, my question to you, to see if you know, because I think it's a perspective that should be brought up. After 1993, when blood-borne pathogen standard was, it was about the year I left Eno Medical Hospital and moved into my OSHA, around 93, 94, okay? Instituting those rules without the needle safety protection.
Right.
What kind of decrease did we see in hepatitis B and C? Now remember, 200 to 300 died every year. Dead's dead. 17,000 were infected. What was the impact of those precautions without the safety needles test, do you know?
If I could address that, I don't have the specific numbers in front of me, but my understanding is that there was really no decrease in the 90s precisely because the needle sticks were still so high and because hospitals weren't buying the safe needles in significant numbers. It was really the Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act of 2000 that started to significantly bring the needle sticks and therefore the hepatitis B cases in particular down. So there is some statistical evidence. For instance, William Charney has in his latest Handbook of Hospital Safety provides statistics, I think it's from 2010, on the number of needle sticks and I think HPV cases. And there is pretty strong evidence that the Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act, because it required people to, employers to purchase safer needles, resulted in a pretty steep drop in the number of needle sticks.
I do know the numbers, because I was watching, from 93 to about 2002. Okay, the bloodborne pathogen, it's in the literature. Bloodborne pathogen rules, which ask you to put on gloves and a bunch of, it decreased the amount of hepatitis B being transmitted to healthcare workers by 95%.
Okay, I should have clarified. I was just talking about the needle stick numbers. I think it mandated vaccinations. Right, because it mandated vaccinations, and that was a huge gain.
Yeah. I'm talking about deaths and the amount of transmission of this hepatitis B and C after the precautions. Now, what was it that accomplished that? Do you know, ma'am? What accomplished that 95% decrease in hepatitis B and C?
My assumption is it's vaccination.
Absolutely. It was biochemical. They made them give us the hepatitis B. But that's a picture that I think needs to be out there. That the vaccination, that's what was killing the masses of women in healthcare, and no one gave a rip about. All right?
It'd be interesting to know.
What we accomplished it with.
I mean, I don't know how that 95% breaks down, or.
Yeah.
And I also don't know what is the incidence of undiagnosed hepatitis B.
True enough, and that was always the case, wasn't it? Before or after.
Right, but if I were going to lean, I was a speculating woman. And what I would say is that nurses and people who are really close to the center of healthcare are getting the vaccinations. There are lots of people who work in hospitals who never get those vaccinations. And who, unless there is a family incident or some accidental, you go in for a blood test and they discover it. Basically, there are lots of people who work in the healthcare industry in an unskilled, semi-skilled part of it that
those numbers came out of CDC because I was there. I had my supervisor, a guy who was 10 years younger than me, died in a medical hepatitis C. And that was the time I was in career into my ocean, and I was the bloodborne pathogen. And that would be part of my presentation. Yeah, I'm pretty confident about that's how much the big problem, the big deaths, decreased because of. And then the needle stick was a group, all important, that needed to have a safe needle app to prevent. But I was counting the number of diagnosed with plus or minus of HIV for between 92 to about 2002. And you could count those individuals, it was a couple dozen. Versus 217,000 a year.
Well,
I think this was
still important.
Again,
this was early on in our research when it's a little bit hard to explain.
Joe was working as my research assistant for 8 years.
And we had determined we were going to write some articles together. And this is really the
first disclosure that we actually have two more in process. But one of the
first things that he told me after he'd been hanging around for a couple of years was precisely that. Was the undiscovered country for a long time that, and how it you
sort of need HIV/AIDS to sort of
lever with the government
to basically
institute these kind of
health and safety standards.
But I think what is also true is that once you have the passage of the Needle Stick Act. The number of needle sticks drops precipitously, and it really significantly improves worker health in the sector.
Yeah, and also two different things. The number of needle stick versus transmission of disease are two different measures.
Yeah, we understand.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm with my OSHA as well, but I was also with the Department of Community Health for a while, and I had another little perspective that I wanted to share as well. I was involved in the
outreach, as the outreach coordinator for infectious diseases, when the University of Gaffney approved, and I was from Michigan, and I would go out and provide information about the safer medical devices. And a lot of it, even though within the standard, it actually did require engineering controls. However, there were parts that were supplemented to the standard to reinforce and to give it more teeth, because our compliance officers, plus at the time when bloodborne pathogen standard came into effect, there really were not as many alternative safer devices on the market. So I think the standard was a little soft on that, even though it was there and it said employers shall use engineering controls, administrative controls, work practice controls, blah, blah, blah. It said they shall, but there really wasn't any teeth behind it, and the supplemental really helped. So when I was doing outreach, the other thing I encountered was the stereotypical nurture martyrdom syndrome that sometimes women have as caregivers. And I was in the Upper Peninsula, and I was doing a presentation. It was a large nursing group, and many from community hospitals, from clinics and things. And one person in the room, you know, stood up, and she was very upset. She said, "So what you're telling me is we have to make a decision whether or not we are going to provide life-saving immunizations to children, or we're going to buy a safer needle. And that's ridiculous to me." And another, and I just got quiet. I'm like, okay, don't shoot the messenger, you know? And another woman in front, she stood up, and she said, "You know what? If one of us dies from a bloodborne pathogen because of our profession, that's one too many, and it's worth the investment." But I mean, even I think among themselves, there was a lot of that kind of struggle, and I don't know if it was maybe, again, what sometimes the stereotypical feminine response of nurture, martyrdom in healthcare played into that.
Worth the deal of the life.
I would rather get a needle stick and make sure that 15 children are immunized than have a safer medical device.
Well, there's some really interesting stuff, and you may know this already, in the nursing history literature that's precisely on those lines. And the again, when you have this corporatization where the medical corporations basically want you to spend, you know, 7.5 minutes per patient, and totally undermine the standard of care that nurses have been taught, and this is another stressor for them. I think the personal stories of these needle sticks, and there's a bunch of them in the hearings, are just so incredible, because it's clear that they're being pushed so hard to do these things, to take on more patients, and that most of the injuries are precisely occurring because they are completely stressed out. They're reaching too far for the box. There is an improper needle. There's one story where they're like patients in crisis, one of them having some sort of psychological episode,
and the nurse gets stuck essentially because she's trying to restrain one patient
while helping another. And it echoes
this sort of,
that the background of those nurses and health caregivers is that you basically put yourself on the line. And yet, it comes back to, if you get sick, then who cares for those patients? And why should you have to choose between immunization of children and a safe workplace?
And with PCH, the other thing is that there were so many of the healthcare workers that were not, like, for instance, the influenza. They were not willing to be vaccinated for influenza. And the majority of the nurses and the doctors were not. The CNAs were, the maintenance folks were, the housekeeping staff, and they were lined up. But you couldn't get the physicians in there to get immunized for, I mean, I don't know why. I have no idea why nurses and docs won't get immunized.
Well, we have a question about here.
What kind of comment about statistics? Where I've worked, when you had an incident, your head on a shelf and got a needle stick or whatever, you filled out a form and you might go to the employee health and stuff like that. You were not allowed to make a copy of that form. You did not have that in your own file. You might make your own notes about it at home. But when I followed up, probably in about the mid to late 80s, on getting stuck with a needle, whatever happened to that, they said, "We have already done that." So it just kind of went off in the ozone. And then when they did start
mandated or even allowed you to have to pay for yourself to have a follow-up later, some weeks or months later,
those tests usually did not pick up seroconversion for some time.
Instead of comparing and say, okay, you were clear now you got it, and you probably already got it, they were trying to say, you were clear,
yes,
day or two, and then you got the real estate, therefore the real estate didn't get it.
Substantial distinctions between the awards made in workers' compensation for people who suffer injuries than people who have diseases.
Right.
I mean, it is, I don't remember the statistics, but it is, I would say, something like they're not only less likely to give you compensation if you've contracted an occupational disease
right.
rather than an injury, but your award will be something like a third of
right.
been given around an injury.
And that's even...
Dr. Ken Rosamond has been following, and he states that the disease that's acquired on the job is way over 100 times fold underreported
yeah.
compared to injury, because the proof is so hard.
Right.
You can't say, as a microbiologist, I can't say, when did you pick up that very virus or bacteria and prove it. They don't come with labels and they don't need track.
Yeah.
All right.
One of Joe's other specializations and what he's been working on for some time is about occupational cancer. And that's another case
very
where they will go to great lengths to sort of
you're
come
a chance
up with, with explanations for where you, you know, got your cancer rather than it being something that happened in the workplace.
I'm Marsha. I'm an industrial hygienist with the Michigan OSHA program, and have now, but there's three real quick things I want to mention is that the hepatitis B vaccination it merely has to be offered, so it's not mandated. Unlike flu vaccines, which sometimes are a condition of employment, the Health Care Worker Protection Act, part of requiring implementation of safe medical devices, in addition to that, one of the things that is was required is to maintain insurance injury log. And one thing that you might note is that employers who are exempt from record keeping anyway do not have to maintain those logs. And that includes offices of doctors and dentists.
Yes,
so I wonder if there is, you know, if you go to the you know, hospital today, you're going to find safe medical devices, but if you go to your dentist, you likely won't. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if failure to require tracking makes those employers not realize the hazard. But my final point was, within the last couple of years, there's kind of been a paradigm shift in terms of infection prevention. You know, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services will not reimburse hospitals and nursing homes for nosocomial infection. And after that change, there's been a distinct drive for implementing safe medical devices to prevent patient infection. And a lot of those devices also are safer to use. So I'll give you my card, and if you ever have any questions, you know, there's a lot of passionate people in Michigan about this issue, including what Marcia mentioned, Dr. Kim Rosen here at MSU.
Great.
And
does
that
have your hand way in the back?
No.
You get called out in here, even when you don't want to ask for a question. Right? Let me, one thing about OSHA, and you guys can correct me on this, but maybe just so that everybody's on the same page about this. When OSHA was passed in 1970, the main thing was it was passed under Richard Nixon and but the other thing that was amazing about it is that the federal government automatically accepted industry standards because of the fact that that was the only way to jumpstart the start of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So the question that I would ask is, to what degree, even when they move forward within healthcare as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, in effect, work hand in glove, so to speak, with the industry when it came to even setting industry standards or whatever? Or to what degree was it, had it matured to the point where it was much more working with SCID and others on the creation of those standards?
My own inclination is one way, but you should speak.
My sense is that OSHA has been a bit of a political football between presidential administrations. I'm not as well informed as I probably ought to be about the OSHA under the Clinton administration, but I know that under the second Bush administration, there was a return to a consensus-based emphasis on standard setting that was quite similar to the Reagan administration. Currently, the head of OSHA, David Michaels, is a little more like Eula Bingham under Carter. He's trying to get more aggressive. But my sense is that, there was recently an article in the New York Times about OSHA, and one of the things they pointed out is that OSHA still has half the budget of the National Fish and Wildlife Administration. So we spend half as much on protecting workers as we do fish and wildlife. Not that fish and wildlife shouldn't be protected, but one would think that it would need a bigger budget. So there's also still very strong lobbying pressure against any OSHA standard period, whether it's on cadmium exposure or what we're talking about.
I can tell you, did OSHA adopt industry standards for healthcare? I had been in healthcare at that time. And what would have been the industry standard? Welding and General Motors, there were industry standards that they embraced. They did not embrace CDC standards. It was CDC who pretty much set up the industry standards for all of healthcare, other than they weren't counting both facts, and they're still not counting both facts, and that's still number one. But they had infectious disease recommendations that I would follow in microbiology from CDC. But you asked my OSHA now and then, 20 years ago,
That's mandatory. And what I objected to when I joined the MyOSHA family, why are we piecemealing infectious disease? Bloodborne pathogen, I realize, that's just got one kind of disease, infectious disease. And there's a whole bunch of other ones, and there is no rule yet that acknowledges the CDC's required industry standards of protection, because they're serious. That's just a big hole, and still there. And I still think two reasons. Part of that industry has a lot of PhDs and degreed individuals who say poop, and that's been listened to. And the other one is, it's a woman's industry, and we're not interested if they're breaking their back more than the guy in General Motors, which they still is, and there is no rules to protect them. It's voluntary. So that would be interesting to them.
Final comment on this campus and around this town, there's more publicity given to damage done to pets by dogs in this article in the paper I have here today than there is to abuse of homo sapiens by the dormitory roommates or whatever. It's crazy.
I was listening to the Peterson's personal comments that you made and the comment that Dylan made back about the paradigm shift in perspective. And I couldn't help but think about how long it takes for any improvement in the human condition to be safeguarded. And I was thinking about this a story I read when British men were for the largest. More men were occupied on the high seas during the time of the British Empire than any other occupation, and scurvy was the disease that they died from the most. Yet it was 250 years from the time that lemons and limes were a solution to the time that it was adopted by the British Navy and the British Navy. Surely we can shorten that.
Thank you for your input.
Thank you very much.